Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place for you to hear from today's leaders in the fields of data, analytics, and customer insight. And as a first for this podcast, this episode is being recorded live at Big Data London 2021 in front of a real people audience. Give us a shout, audience.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Anyway, back to the podcast. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Roberto Maranca. With more than 25 years' experience in the world of IT and data, Roberto spent most of his working life within General Electric in their capital division, where since 2014, as their chief data officer for their international unit, he's implemented data governance, quality, and advanced analytics. It spans supporting risk model validation to enabling divestitures and leading their regulatory reporting investments. Ooh, how exciting. After a year as group chief data officer at Lloyds Banking Group, even more exciting, shaping a new data strategy, he's now joined Schneider Electric, where he's the Data Excellence VP, delving into the cultural and methodological aspects of becoming a data-driven company. Welcome, Roberto. What an intro.
Thank you, Paul. What an intro, actually. And forgot I wrote that.
Well, good to have you with us. Yeah. Always a pleasure. Roberto and I met first, I think, when I was chairing Data Leaders Summit in Barcelona.
Barcelona was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, but your engaging persona made you a definite target for this podcast. So I think you know, Roberto, with every guest I've had on this podcast, I ask them to start off by giving us their career story, their backstory, if you like, so that listeners know where you're coming from.
So how long is the podcast?
Tell us how you've developed as a data leader. What's your story?
Yeah, my story, I need to go a little bit further back, because that will come back in what we discuss. So my mum wanted me to be an archaeologist, but actually I wanted to be a fighter pilot. The problem was at the time in Italy, because I'm from there, and the planes were F-104s. It's like a pipe with a hole in it. And I couldn't fit in the plane more than my knees. I'd actually try that. So I need to recycle myself as a aeronautical engineer. But I came out of aeronautical engineering, and there was no job going. So I had to recycle myself as an IT guy. And then I started in Nissan, Nissan and Ford were for me great school. So I learned everything. I started from help desking I implement the first ones and LANs emails. So I kind of between the 90s and the beginning of the 2000, I was learning a little bit of everything in IT, and especially in Ford. I remember that managing a little data center, I was having a kind of a mineshaft experience, which you go down in the data center, you shut the door, you have this huge operational thing happening for 12, 14 hours, you go home, you sleep, you go back in the office. Mm. But at the same time, I started to understand there was a connection between the value of technology to what you want to bring to the business, because technology for technology's sake doesn't work. So GE was the place in which I did my transition from IT to data. I had the luck to be with a boss that was actually very trustworthy in me, and so was giving me kind of everything. And one of the things he gave me was the responsibility of Basel II. For the people that are not knowing financial services, it's a huge exercise of collecting data from all the banks.
Absolutely.
Classify your data by product, by type of customer, put everything in an engine and calculating numbers. So huge data exercise. And I was having that from a technical point of view, but more interestingly, I was also dealing with, you know, business people. And trying to explain why we want to do that. Mm-hmm. So that was my baptism fire in data. So he opened up all the boxes that I ticked when I saw the first job description of a chief data officer, because G was getting regulated by the Federal Reserve. And so they were very adamant in having what they were calling at the time data czars, right? And luckily they became data officer. And so when I saw the first job description, I said, ha, this is what I want to do. And this is what I want to do when I grow up, because I was, oh, that's metadata. Ah, that's data quality. Ah, that's data governance. So things clicked. And I was ready to do a many, many years of you know, remediating what GE Data was, but GE decided to sell GE Capital. So I found myself a bit in a dark place. After 70 years, you are basically dismantling what you've done in the last 70 years, and you are selling the business. But at the same time, it was a bit of a our darkest hour, but our finest hour, because we started to do proper data stuff, helping our M&A team.
Yes.
And helping our regulatory reporting team to do the right thing with data. So right. That was interesting. And then from there, I moved to Lloyds. And in Lloyds, you know, big bank, big household name, so different type of problems. I think in Lloyds, what I learned, I was implementing for the second time GDPR, because I started in...
Right. And no one deserves twice.
Well, that's a third time lucky. And so the... what I did with Lloyds was, in Lloyds, what I appreciated a lot was the power of metadata and how it's important to understand where the data is, what the data does, who's got the data, where it goes. And finally, because, well, in Lloyds, it was a huge transformation, and, you know, sometimes you don't survive this type of huge transformation. So I decided to move to a place where you could make stuff. We were making stuff. There is a product to touch and see and smell. And there was a big IoT play and a meaningful mission. And Schneider was there. Schneider, for the ones that are not knowing it, is a basically an energy management manufacturer. So they do a lot of components from high, medium, and low voltage. And possibly people don't know there's 150,000 people almost working for Schneider in 100 countries. Wow. So there's big company and very hungry for data. So I think Schneider, what I experienced was, because I joined when the data team was just formed, and I was trying to build for them, help them to build the scaffolding of data, what I called then, because of my experience, was data excellence, right? And so basically, how do you manage the cultural change to make it more receptive of the data? How you give them the methodology of changing the way they change so they don't forget their data? Yeah. And how they give them the value model to understand what it means for me if I do this from a value point of view.
Yes.
And there was an interesting, you know, transition of, and making Schneider understanding that the D in data officer is not for dashboard at any beginning, then becomes data.
Yes.
And finally you approach into decision. So I think it's helping decision that data driven and those decision providing you value is what in the end, I think is the juice of it.
Yes.
So that's,
a whistle-stop tour of your career.
Yeah,
tremendous, Roberto. Yeah. Thank you. A few things I'd like to pick up on there. So I like the emphasis you had there on all the embedding in the way that change is done, the consideration of data. I've published quite a bit of content. We had a few posts and guest posts on data literacy on the Customer Insight Leader blog. And in its approach, data literacy programs are approached in a whole variety of ways by different organizations, but haven't always heard protecting that bit, that the way that you do change has to change. Yeah. In order to consider data at each stage. Do you want to share a bit more about that?
Yeah, my kind of a epiphany, let's call it that.
Epiphany is a good word.
Epiphany was that having coming from an IT background in which I've been managing and setting up project management offices.
Yes.
So I was looking after the sausage factory of IT.
Yes.
The realization is that, okay, when we do things, we design for IT and process change.
Mm.
Or we get the requirements for IT process change first.
Yes.
Then we design for IT process change.
Yes.
Then we build for IT and process change. Then at test, we are reminded data.
Yeah.
Because at test, someone will come and say, this is not good enough for me.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, so the idea is that, why don't you require data? So you have an understanding of what data required. You design for data. Yeah. Maybe you assess whether data is good enough.
Yes. Yes.
Then you build for data.
Yes.
And then you operate for data.
Yes.
So you have so that's the change in the way we change. It's basically don't forget about data.
Yeah, I like that. Really important. And with my similar experience of a career in IT before moving across to the data world, I can see the importance of that and how many mistakes that have been made over the years it avoids. got to pick up on your D's as well. Now, I know you've spoken on this as well, because I've seen the... And for those listening on the podcast, if you ever get the chance to see Roberto Maranco on stage for live, take it.
But you just are.
Don't go in the front row. You know,
sorry,
he's
the one
that's dynamic chap.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. D's. This chief dashboard officer, nice gag, I get it, and there's plenty of organizations who are still at the chief dashboard officer. Chief data officer, I like the further maturity into chief decision officer. So lots of organizations, I guess, are trying to find the secret source of that, to break through. How do they stop just being a, by the book, the book's being sold here as well, chief data officer, to actually driving decisions, I'm guessing, is what you're getting
it
at.
It is.
How do you make that change to be treated like a chief decision officer in the organization?
Well, it's part of the cultural change you need to bring, because the main, of course, we are human beings are experiencing things, right? What you experience of data is your dashboard. I mean, there's something on the screen that you pick, you use, you make a decision for that, and then you're trying to get some value.
Yeah.
So when you bring in someone that's data, the thing you want the most is to have more of that.
Yes.
So you want more of that thing. You want, maybe your dashboard is blue, you prefer it green. Or maybe there is a drop down, four values, you need three.
Yeah.
So
that's
the first experience. That's the first misnomer, misunderstanding that probably you need to work with. And it's interesting, because the passage between the three Ds is basically more or less the different stages of awareness of a company around data.
Okay.
So this is not just a dashboard. This is something that needs a bit of an economy, an infrastructure, a process behind. So then moving from the dashboard thing, so what's on the screen, to understand what comes behind the screen.
Yes.
It's a bit like when you move from, you know, I just buy something at the supermarket, and now I buy something that is DOP or DOC. So it's guaranteed from farm to fork.
Yes.
You want to have, you become a aware, a consumer that is more aware.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So no, and this is not just a dashboard. I want to know where it's coming from.
Yes.
I want to know who did it. I want to know who owns it. I want to know how it's made.
Yes, yes.
And that's so the passage to a D, it makes you more in charge of what this business of data, the supply chains of data. So how do I guarantee the provision of what these guys are needing? And then the next step is based on the proving yourself as you know what you're talking about from an expertise. Now you're crossing with the intimacy of the business.
Yes.
Now you can help me to find what I don't know.
Yeah.
So you help my decision, telling me, look, maybe you forgot this aspect of this problem that I can see from the data, but you didn't see yet. So I can help you to make a better decision. So what I'm trying to do, because, and actually it's a good play with the agile methodologies, right? I'm trying now, I'm pushing out the need for data consumer stories. So if I know exactly what happens to the data when it leaves the screen, actually I know better what's the nexus between the data and the value.
Yes.
So if I know better than nexus,
yes,
I can help you to make your cost-benefit analysis better, because I can tell you, look, for that algorithm to give you a better branding, you know, prediction or order prediction, you don't need to have 100% customer accuracy. 85% is good enough. So it's actually the true fit for purpose that helps your decision.
Yeah, no, that makes good sense. It reminds me a lot of the power for analysts and data scientists to have better domain knowledge, so that they actually apply what they do in the context of a deeper understanding of what's going on in the organization and why.
But it's a business empathy.
Yeah, business empathy. It's good language. The other thing I've got to pick up on, we both shared the joy / challenge of working in Lloyds Banking Group for a period of time.
Yeah.
During that, you mentioned metadata and reference data, which doesn't always, maybe a bit like banks, get a lot of love. And I was keen to hear you talk about it, actually, because I guess if I was to have a bit of a pop at CDOs, I tend to hear that CDOs want to talk about big, sexy transformation projects, maybe a little bit about data quality, a bit about data protection, governance, that kind of stuff. Not always that much about metadata and really understanding what the meaning of the data is in the real world. What is metadata getting neglected even by CDOs, Roberto?
I don't know if everyone is neglecting it. What I can tell you is that when I joined Lloyds, it was clear to me, and I was actually saying that, if there is only one thing I can be successful at, let it be metadata.
Right.
Because with that, I have the keys to everything. I mean, I'm profoundly believing, and actually I'm kind of proving it more and more, that if I know at any point in space, at any point in time, what my data does, what my data is, who's got my data, where it goes, what is used for, there is no regulation I can't answer to. No regulation I can't answer, because the regulation will usually ask you, how do you know this is happening?
Yes.
And how do you you substantiate that? Presenting your data, knowing where your data is, right? And so there is no problem of simplification, optimization I can't solve because I see it. All of a sudden, my risks are not risks anymore, are actually visible aspect of what I do. So there is a level of self-awareness at the company level in which I can see through my data myself.
Yes.
And I know exactly where I stand. Maybe it's more than metadata, but in effect is organizational metadata, is rich understanding of what are the relationships and the operational dimensions of what you do. So I don't want to just know this is customer type and customer type is used for a customer. I want to know why am I using it?
Yes, yes.
What's the purpose? Yes. What is the relationship to being better at doing customer management? So that's when I took metadata, is in a very wide sense.
But
still, I think it's the description of what you do with your data.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like it. It reminds me, actually, I hadn't joined the dots, I don't think, before hearing you say that, of still that business empathy theme. It's too much of the quality work I've seen sometimes is all about running it again like a sausage factory. You know, how many nulls has it got? Is it within valid range? Can I automate this as a checking process? And you could still be treating it like the proverbial can of baked beans. It's just, it's a piece of data. It has to go through this process.
And then so what?
So what? Yeah. No empathy as to why and what it's meaning.
I fixed 25,000 addresses last month. So what?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Always, always ask that. Okay, good stuff. Let's come back to, because since we're on this kind of business empathy, empathic human theme, let's come back to you talking about your darkest hour.
Yes, divesting
a
business.
Not the fine feature film, although I can imagine Roberto in a film somehow. So every data leader has them. Certainly if you live long enough, you will go through some tough times when there's a business decision that goes against you or things aren't pushed forward.
Especially
the way you
later.
And I guess for a lot of leaders, those times can cause a lot of self-doubt, a lot of kind of tough times.
Depression.
Depression, you're right, yeah. And it's useful, I think, for people to hear that even when it doesn't go well, there are things that can help you get through those times, not just always have success. So it sounded like there was an element of positive attitude. There was an element of you got quite stuck into some detail. What helped you through that time? What helped you to continue to stay focused?
But I have to say, before we go to more of the business approach,
I
think you need to be incredibly careful with your mind and your health. Mind health, mental health is important. Yes. So I think what that moment taught me is that you need to find a way to be structuring what you do in a way that you being in what you're doing also some element that makes you feel better, independent from what's going on.
Yes.
So
yes.
Sport, hobbies, gardening, sailing, whatever it works for you, cultivate it.
Yes.
Because sometimes the temptation is to say, things are going wrong, I need to put fully myself into this.
Yeah.
And then you might be pushed off the cliff. So I think a good separation from what's going on, and degree of separation is good.
Okay.
Then secondly, more from a business point of view, the realization was when you are in that environment which everything seems to basically fold on yourself and then you are oppressed by the change, I think you need to, instead of technically say, oh, we need a tool that will solve this, or we need a new process.
Yes.
Sometimes it's good to go back into your drawers and say, okay, let's see what I have.
Yeah, okay.
And maybe the best tool to solve your problem is a tool you have already. Yeah. So what we did specifically in G when we were, divesting the business, we, like in the Apollo 13, you know, when they're having a problem with the air filter. So we literally went into the door and said, okay, we have a bit of IDQ. Yeah. We have a bit of an Oracle database.
Yeah.
Can we do something
that
is actually helping us to be faster in selling? And that's what we did. So there was a specific thing we did for an M&A team that was trying to sell a multi-business, multi-country, multi-product, and you can't do that in Excel. So we tried to do something that was helping them to do faster and to go through the transaction in a faster way, in a more reliable way. And basically, we used all our bits and pieces we're having around, and now we're not used anymore because we're selling the business.
Yes.
And we repurposed that. And basically, we gave them a different breath of life,
yes.
if you see.
Yeah.
So,
good.
And that was a satisfactory thing to do.
Yes.
Not only for us, but also for the people that were managing those tools, those capabilities, yeah. that were yeah. actually kind of a twiddling their thumbs a little bit,
yeah.
right? So it was,
yes.
was, but of course it was short in its life because it's still the end was coming and you know that you are literally switching off lights. So there's a point in which you need to move on.
Yes, yes, yes. No, that sounds sensible. How during that do you keep the balance right? I guess a lot of data and analytics leaders have this kind of dual challenge of being hands-on enough that you technically know what you're talking about and you can help the team ruffle in the cupboard and find a bit of Oracle, a bit of Sellotape, a bit of Blue Tack. And at the same time, not micromanaging your team. And many technical leaders have risen up from being technical and they want to stay strategic and set the general direction and just empower people. How did you get that right in that time? Is it that
sometimes I don't.
Go on.
Sometimes I don't because I think having an heritage in IT helps, but it hinders, right, as well, because you still think that stuff is working with SQL script. Doesn't do anymore.
Yes.
But or it does, maybe. But I think you need to maintain the balance. It's definitely need to be hands-on, because in a lot of what we do, you need to understand what's going on.
Yes.
But then you don't need to let that impeding people in your team to come up with a different view, come up with a different decision, come up with something that works, maybe works better. Mm. I think the big learning, and it's a tough learning for someone like me. I got big size ego, right? And
no.
Unfortunately. And so the learning sometimes is that the purest and the most beautiful solution you have in mind that you want to pursue is possibly better adopted if it's toned down. Maybe it's something that is not perfect, but if it's adopted by more people.
Yes, yes.
In G, we were having this fantastic formula, which was E equals Q times A, where E stands for efficiency and Q stands for quality, A is adoption.
Right.
So if you have something that is a fantastically well, high quality, but not adopted, your efficiency is still not going to be good. So something is adopted by many, at a lower quality gives you more efficiency.
Good point, good point. Yeah, and I can think of many change leaders, not just data and analytics leaders.
That's change. That actually comes from the change acceleration process in GE. So yes, definitely.
It's a good focus. Adoption doesn't get focused on enough, I agree. Something else I was keen to pick up on, I'm aware as you've transition between those roles.
Mm-hmm.
You've made a name for yourself, Roberto. You're well known among kind of data leaders.
Famed.
That's it. Let's call it
famed. With a D at the end.
Okay. But you've clearly managed to effectively network, effectively connect, and share experience with people in other organisations. Many people in their careers, as they're going to get on as analysts and grow into data leaders, are encouraged to raise their profile or to network effectively. And yet they can find it quickly slips into a bit of a time drain. They're just at lots of events. Maybe they find a way that isn't working for them.
Yeah.
You've made it work for you. What are your tips for having that outside view, for effectively having a connection?
Pace yourself.
Okay.
I mean, because you don't want to go, of course. Today for me is a nice day being back into something like this after two years.
Know.
I mean, it's...
I know.
Although as you can see, my data friends are not all here.
Yes.
But I think it's again a balance, right? So I think you need to be curious of what's going on around you, because it's too easy to lock yourself into your office and just thinking about your problems. So having a mind to bounce idea off is useful.
Yes.
But it's be a bit of a give and take, right?
Yes.
So you can't get to this type of events and say, I want to just meet the top, you know, brass and then top data guy because I want to suck the hell out of them, right? I think you need to be very democratic with your time. So you allocate time and basically you're trying to spend time with people that are maybe different from you in terms of a company, industry, what they're doing, and maybe they've done a completely different experience. Because in this type of, let's call it mutual mentoring, when you have a peer-to-peer connect, the true peer-to-peer connect, you learn when you explain and you learn when you listen, if you listen.
Yeah, yeah.
Not if you're hearing. I know in English there's the difference between the sensorial bit, which is hearing.
Yeah.
And that's, because sometimes I hear you, yes, but you're not listening, right? So if you do that, I think it's good to understand what's going on.
Mm.
It's having a network always helps in changing your in changing one day your job, right? Because things are changing and you want to do something different. And also tells you where is the world going next.
Yes.
So open curiosity, being curious about what's happening. And my professor of aerodynamics is probably the best example. He was a genius. He was really a genius. Okay. He was a genius. But yeah, I remember him just going in front, waiting for the elevators at the university and still putting on his glasses to read one of those, you know, posters that were there just for people searching for a housemate. And he was giving almost 2 seconds of curiosity to everything that was coming in his field vision. So I think it's a good approach.
Curiosity.
Curiosity.
Nice.
Doesn't kill the cat. Curiosity.
Great. Great. Nice. Nice. I didn't think you'd resist it. Okay. This has been great, Roberto. Final question for you. I'm keen to always emphasize in this podcast that success in these kind of careers is something that people can kind of develop towards, and there are lessons to be learned by the way along the way. People who are a bit earlier in their career, so they may be analysts, they may be data scientists or learning their trade as a data engineer. Given what you've learned, what are your experiences back to people at the beginning of the career journey?
You're asking me what kind of approach should they want?
What skills should they be developing,
do you think? I want to be provocative here. I want to see someone actually standing up and leaving when I say that.
Okay, I'll tell you, listeners, if they do.
Philosophy.
Philosophy.
Nobody's leaving? Okay, it's good.
Philosophy.
But
I'll buy it. What do you mean by philosophy for data analysts?
I mean that, for me, what you see around you is a bit of an illusion. Meaning that what is going to make us good leaders is not the technology, but actually our ability to understand the human that uses the technology.
Right.
And I think we are at a point in time where we have a convergence between human sciences and technical sciences. And the people that can actually merge them, converge them, syncretically, using a Greek derived word, use them, they're going to be the winners. And one thing you need to understand better is that if you read, as I read, tragedies and comedies in the Greeks and the Latins, 25 centuries ago, 30 centuries ago, human being has not changed a lot. And funny enough, when you train a model, you find the same things. You find the bias, you find the lust, you find the greed, you find the reluctance to accept truth.
And
unfortunately, that's something that call it sociology, call it psychology, but I think philosophically, especially when we go in the ethical part of what we do as data, it's a fundamental skill that you need to blend into what you're doing.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Roberto. It's been great to spend time with you today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Paul.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you found it helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. New episodes all the time and other conversations with similar data leaders. There's also regularly fresh content on customerinsightleader.com, the blog. So feel free to have a look at that as well. Before then, it just remains for me to say thank you very much for your time and perhaps think about thinking philosophically a bit. There we go. That's your thought for the day. Goodbye, everybody.
Nice one.